Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Welcome to Your True North. I'm your host, Cindy Camp. Today I will be talking with Gerald Murnane, an author from Australia, who's written over a dozen books, including The Plains, and most recently, Border Districts. He worked as a teacher during the early part of his career, and he's a great fan of horse racing. It's an honor to have you as a guest with me today, and I want to welcome you, Gerald. Yeah, it's great to be talking with you. Your True North interviews are focused on uncovering guests' personal compass or guiding principles. For many, childhood experiences play an important role. I know that your childhood was marked by frequent moves from one home to another. How do you think that affected you?
One practical effect was that I have hardly any written records of my first 15 or 16 years. In the room where I'm sitting, there are 44 filing cabinet drawers full of papers, letters, documents, diaries, journals, all kinds of papers relating to my recording my adult, most of my adult life. And I'm always sorry that there's hardly any juvenilia, as they're called, papers. I wrote little plays and short stories, attempts at all kinds of literary things as a young boy, and none of them survived because of the fact that we moved so often. The moves were mostly the result of my father's gambling. He didn't drink or smoke. He wasn't a bad man, but he was a gambler who used to try to improve his financial circumstances by moving from one job to another or one rented house to another. And I thought it was a bit of an adventure as a kid. But it's affected me, first of all, as I said just now, that I have very few records of my early life. The other thing is I have no lifelong friends, no one that I had to make friends and lose them along the way as a young person. It's not that I can't make friends, but that I must have become a bit wary, I think, as a kid of becoming close to people, because the threat was always hanging over me that I would lose that friendship, or that we'd be whisked away. Dad was always talking about his next move. So, not loneliness, but a feeling of isolation and just a bit of a reluctance to get close to people. They'd be some of the effects.
And I'm wondering, you mentioned writing as a child. I'm thinking about books as well and wondering what role they played for you and whether you can think of a book that was significant to you then and that you still admire today.
Not really. My childhood, there were very few books in my childhood. I just read what I could get my hands on. I bought books from every opportunity. I recall a few characters from books, but what you've asked leads me to go off on in a slightly different direction. A book of mine, I wouldn't ever say that one book of mine is superior to the others, but I will say that one of my best books is a book called A Million Windows. It's been published in the United States in recent years by a small publisher, David R. Godin from New Hampshire, I think. Anyway, the publisher is Godin, and the book is called A Million Windows. And in that book, I've set out what I'd call my theory of reading. And my theory of reading is quite original, and I can't explain it here except to say that a lot more is taking place. I'll say I, because it may not happen for other people. When I'm reading, I'm not just simply decoding a couple of words. There's a whole lot of imaginative construction and imaginative exercises taking place. For example, I can remember reading a book called Hereward the Wake. It was an old English book. It wasn't actually for kids, I don't think. It was written by a man called Charles Kingsley in the 19th century.
And Gerald, what was the title? Say the title again.
I'll spell the man's name, Hereward, H-E-R-E-W-A-R-D, Hereward the Wake,
okay.
W-A-K-E, Hereward the Wake was an English, a guerrilla leader fighting the invading, I can't even remember which invasion of England it was set in, but he was fighting in the Fens in the flat, wet country to the east of England. And he had a wife called Torfrida, whom he later abandoned, and she became a heroine of mine. Hmm. And I realised that while I was reading about Torfrida, I was imagining a great deal about her that wasn't in the book. So in a nutshell, my theory of reading is that I, and perhaps other people like myself, open up a book, not just to find out what the words, what the actual words are in the book, but to surrender to an experience that brings into being, I call them personages, not characters. The characters are the people who come out of the text, but personages are people who appear from nowhere in the reader's mind and who are helped into being by the act of reading. I hope I've made a little bit of sense. It's a very complicated thing that's spelled out in great deal in my book, A Million Windows. But books have inspired me. I haven't read as many books as you'd imagine. When I find a book, I'll remembrance of things past. Obviously, I didn't read that as a child. Hmm. As a child, but I read it in twice in my 20s and 30s, and I could read that book. If somebody said to me, "You're not allowed to read any more books, just one," I think I'd read that for the rest of my life.
Mm.
I've been devoted to certain books rather than just being an omnivorous lover of all kinds of books.
Well, how many times would you say you've read Remembrance of Things Past?
Twice. But parts of it I've read perhaps 10 times, the last few chapters.
Yeah.
But the whole book twice, yeah. I used to travel to work by train for many years in the city of Melbourne, in the suburbs, and I got a lot of reading done on the train, so that was how I managed to read Proust twice.
And I'll ask you, Proust wrote that fictional characters can seem more real or easier to love than the actual people with whom we share our lives. Did you feel this way as a child or now as an adult?
Undoubtedly. I've partly answered that question by talking about these...
The personages,
The personages, and here's another thing about my reading. There would be characters in fiction. I used to read, as I said, no children's books were available to me. I used to read what my parents read. I was a precocious reader, and they didn't mind me reading sort of light romance and library, we called it library fiction, the sort of entertainment books. They don't exist now because television took their place. People used to read at night. My mother and father read, sitting up in bed, go through two or three books a week. And they'd often allow me to read them, so this book's all right to read. They were terrified that they wouldn't let me read anything that was passionate romance, that kind of thing. But I can remember reading a series of books set in New Zealand, just about a family. And I made up... partly in writing and partly just in my own mind, I made up a whole series of adventures for that family, that New Zealand family. What I was doing was imagining what was happening to them in the days and weeks when they weren't being written about. If I make myself clear, so that if I fell in love with some characters in a book, I would then invent personages based on these characters, and I would imagine what the personages did when they were not being written about, when there was no text to describe what they were doing. I haven't done it much as an adult, but that was one of my favourite childhood activities, falling in love in a light-hearted, not a serious kind of way, but falling in love with characters and working out the lives that nobody knew about. The authors hadn't written about these lives. It was up to me to try and work out what these other adventures and ups and downs that, these people had.
Yeah, thank you for giving that example and really making clear the distinction that you draw between a character in a book and the personage that appears in your mind as you think about the life they might lead. I'm wondering as well if you have any heroes or important role models, especially ones from your childhood.
Oh, look, I don't want to make it sound as though I was a profound, serious-minded little guy right from the start. I was crazy until about my 12th or 13th year. I was crazy about sport and had footballers and cricketers and such for heroes. But the heroes that passion died away quickly. What I do want to mention is that the subject of horse racing. Now, this is something that I find very hard to explain, but I did manage to explain it to a group of literary scholars at a conference not long ago when they devoted themselves to reading papers about my books. When I've had what would we call it, a kind of peak experience during reading, and as any listener would know, towards the end of some books, really the books that really affect the person, towards the end of the book, your hair begins to stand on end, and you maybe even something approaching a tear comes to your eye, and you suddenly see into the mystery of things, or you believe you do. Some people, I won't speculate about other people. For me, at the peak moment of reading, and I noticed this even as a boy, perhaps in his teens or even earlier, I saw in mind the finish of an imaginary horse race. Now, if that sounds incredible, it is true. Something about horse racing, and I knew about horse racing before I could even read, because my father listened to races on the radio and came home at night from the races and told my mother the happy or sad stories of the horses that he'd backed that day. So horse racing invaded my mind at a very early age, and if I was having a kind of deep experience as a reader, it quite often brought to my mind, as I said, a close finish where several horses were vying for supremacy, for the winning position. And I took no notice of this for years. I mean, it just developed. It happened more and more often. And it also happened while I listened to music. We're not talking about music at the moment, but I'll bring in the subject. I was always very susceptible to music. We only listened to the radio, and my parents had no interest whatever in what might be called serious or classical music. But when I heard something that affected me, a piece of music, the music itself was not enough, it seemed. Lo and behold, there was this finish of a horse race in my mind. And this is explained in detail in my book, Something for the Pain. Something for the Pain is called A Memoir of the Turf. It's my life story told in connection with horse racing. And these imaginary horse races led me, and I'm getting a little bit off the subject here, but it's got to be mentioned somewhere, and I'll take this opportunity. These imaginary horse races led me several times during my life to setting out with pen and paper the details of imaginary horse racing worlds, places like Australia or like New Zealand, but obviously they weren't the same as Australia and New Zealand. And I made up imaginary trainers and imaginary jockeys, and I gave them all names, gave them their histories and colours, and imaginary horses. And I worked out ways of using random numbers to have these horses engage in imaginary races. And the reason I did it was because it seemed to me that the act of reading or the act of listening to music was not the final part of my being inspired, but somewhere in the far reaches of my mind there were these imaginary horse races appealing to me or demanding to be taken notice of. Now, there's a fair bit to swallow for you, Sydney.
Yeah, well, and as you're saying this, Gerald, and I know you said you'd only speak for yourself, but you're a keen observer of your own conscious thoughts and even subconscious, and I'm guessing that there are other people who can identify with what you're describing, that we have these sort of imaginary images that we walk around with, and especially in peak moments that are there for us.
And I hope I'm making sense to at least a few of your listeners. And if I am, I'll just go on to say that I place I place a great deal of importance on those images. How do I know what saints and visionaries in the past actually saw? When I used to read as a kid that such and such a saint had a vision, I thought, how lucky for them. Pity it couldn't happen to me, and of course it won't. But I liken my, what I call imaginary horse racing imagery, I liken that imagery to what other people might have called in the past visions. And if they're visions, and I'm entitled to call them whatever I like, because they're my property, so to speak. If they're visions, I want to find out more about them. I want to take note of them and try to understand them and why they're there.
And have you written about these in some of your books?
Oh, well, there's a small chapter in the whole of my first book, which hasn't been ever published in America, my first book was called Tamarisk Grow. Tamarisk is a tree, a native of North Africa, and there were tamarisk trees in my backyard in Bendigo as a small boy, and I built a toy imaginary race course under a tamarisk tree, and I called the property where a nearby property where my favourite racehorse owner lived was called Tamarisk Grow. The Tamarisk Grow is full of dreams and images of horse racing, but the only place where I've stated in my writing, where I've given an account of my dedication to these visions, if I call them that, is a chapter called, it's called "They're Racing in the Antipodes." It's in the book Something for the Pain, only a small chapter, and many people have approached me and said, "Why? Tell me more about this." They're fascinated by the fact why it's called the Antipodes. The Antipodes, of course, was the old name for the big country that was supposed to be on the other side of the world. And Antipodes is sometimes used to describe the two countries of Australia and New Zealand. And the imaginary world that I created and gave the most detail to, and I still in my filing cabinet, I call it the Antipodes. It's a place, it's two land masses, a bit like New Zealand. What did you ask? Yes, that's the only account. And I'm very reluctant. I used to keep it secret. I didn't even tell my wife about it for years. I thought this is almost childish, but I'm not ashamed of it at all nowadays. As I'm getting to a rather advanced age. I remember, not that I'm a great admirer of Carl Jung, but I can never forget that he was supposed to have, in his last years, supposed to have deliberately played the games, some of the games he played as a child, in order to learn from them. And my first games were horse racing games, and I'm still playing them, and I'm only 1 year short of my 80th year.
This is part one of a two-part show. Join us again next week to hear the conclusion of our conversation.
You've been listening to Your True North with Cindy Camp. The opinions expressed on today's episode are not necessarily those of WXAV 88.3 FM, St. Xavier University, or the producers of Your True North. For a copy of today's program, you can download it as a podcast by visiting yourtruenorthpodcasts.com. Thank you very much for listening to Your True North.